welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are in the North Carolina debates, and we want to get right into that. I understand that there are a lot of things going on, and all of the little things only when possibly another day or a myopic issue. If you look at every single thing that is going on that people are clinging hope to, whether it be the election integrity, whether it be states nullifying, I can't emphasize enough, folks, that the federal government will continue to reign tyranny until they destroy this nation. And what I mean by that is the communists who have taken over and are blatantly violating our Constitution, they're out to destroy our Constitution and our Republic. They're going to drive us into a global government. The only way, let me emphasize this, the only way we are going to turn this around is not by these little issues that you were seeing in the news. If it's on Fox, if it's on any news station, because I'm telling you right now, there is no news station. Only once did Epoch Times, and that's because of Trevor Lawton, actually ran an article regarding Republic Review. There is no news station that is getting into the details of the power that the states possess in collectively forcing the federal government into compliance to their compact. They don't want you to know that all we need is a simple majority. As you see what's going on in Congress, in both the Senate as well as the House of Representatives, most all the things they're doing is with basic majorities in both of these houses. The requirement of 60 senators was washed away when the Republicans, as well as the Democrats, washed away those higher bars to require a greater majority than just 50% plus one. Bottom line, when it comes to resolutions and the federal government dismantling things that it has no constitutional authority to do, we only need 50% plus one in Congress. In both houses, this means that all we need are 27 states. We don't need 34 states to convene a convention. And when I say convention, I'm talking about pulling people together. I am talking about, and I'm putting this in context, so people understand that it does require 34 states to petition to amend the Constitution. And when I say convention, I'm talking about a process, right? There are methodical processes in engineering, and they are accepted conventions that we follow. And so when we look at this term convention, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is a body of delegates working on the Constitution to make changes or wholesale rewriting. That's a very unique convention. But convention, and the word convention, does not only apply to that. Let those people who are trying to tell you that there is only one use of the word convention, like the John Birchers, and anybody else that's running around using demagoguery for that word, I'm sorry. Go look at the dictionary. That word has very different meanings. And so what we need is the states to pull together to go through the process, again, a convention, working together to rid the states of all of this unconstitutional government. And we get into this with Republic Review of why we only need a majority. Because then we have the political force. And how do we have political force? The Constitution gives states the right to charge anybody, any state resident, which means that anybody that's in Congress who is a resident from that state, representing that state and the people of that state, they can be charged with treason and extradited back to the state to be tried. And to be very clear, the Attorney General, all you need is 27 states with full commitment to this. And if you understand, once we have 13 states, we kill any opportunity for an Article 5 convention. In other words, we now have 13 states that say, we don't care what amendments you put on the table or what you want to do regarding amendments. We care about enforcing our contract, the Constitution, and making sure that you are in full compliance before we consider anything else. Because we have to recognize the money, the trillions of dollars Biden is spending in building and giving this money to his loyalists, like creating this department of babysitting. He's laying a foundation to enter into your home by this latest boondoggle of money, unconstitutionally taking money and unconstitutionally spending this money. Anyway, so there's nothing in the news that is going to save us. And they want you to be just enthralled. They want you to, you know, ensconce yourself in the problem du jour. This way, you are absolutely useless. You can't get engaged in the solution. You're engaged in the problem. And they keep on getting people. I have to appreciate the fact of how Tactical Civics uses the term of the news cycle as pornography. It is addictive, and people are so caught up in this concept of the news cycle. And, oh, what this problem is, and how are we going to fix this? We fix every problem that is currently going on with Republic Review. It's that simple. You want to fix all of the problems with one fell swoop? Force full compliance to the Constitution. And that process is called Republic Review. Dare I say that word convention? That convention or process or methodology of what Jefferson and Madison did in 1798 is Republic Review. And Republic Review is not what I say it is. It is what the states say it is as they move forward in auditing. When you understand the auditing process, either it's in the compact or it's not in the compact. You can't start making changes and willy-nilly interpretations. It's either there. And, oh, by the way, that's why we go through the ratification debates. Because now there's no ambiguity regarding the terms and definitions. That's why these debates are so important. So that we have a clear understanding and remove any type of interpretation so that the state legislatures clearly understand that the federal government is limited to the enumerated powers. If it ain't enumerated, they can't do it. Education, energy, housing, labor, all of these things that they're exercising, or even getting into the regulation of products in commerce, they don't have that authority. Their authority in commerce is limited to dealing with foreign trade and ensuring that states don't take commercial or market space advantage over others. And the federal government can't be choosing what products they want to endorse or allow to be produced and what products they won't. This is the clarity that you're going to get out of the ratification debate. So let me just move forward with some of the obligatories. This show is sponsored by republicreview.org. And this is the only show. That's why we go through. That's why I'm going to be the first one to admit I'm not the most professional. I'm not the most well-polished person. But when I am telling you an argument, it's irrefutable. Because it's not my argument, it is the framers' argument. I love being right. And there's many times and many assertions that I make in my personal life and with things outside the context of the Constitution. I may not be right. But when it comes down to Republic Review, nobody can refute it. That's why nobody wants to get into a real debate with me. They want to come after me and try to prove their argument, but they cannot disprove mine. This is why ad hominem types of attacks and or arguments are constantly used with me. Oh, well, in his book, when he first started thinking about this, you know, he talked this way or he mentioned that. Well, my books stand today as the most relevant books out there because I am actually having a conversation regarding what it's going to take to fix all of our problems. You know, when we start looking at the Constitution, it is perfect. It was perfect to get us to this point, and it's perfect to move us forward. Anybody that says that we have to have a constitutional convention so that they can, you know, start exchanging parts or rewriting it all together, are you kidding? We don't have the time, for one, for them to play that way, nor do we care to let them basically destroy or pervert our Constitution. We actually, if you understand Republic Review, I'll just say this. If you understand Republic Review, it will allow the removal of the Article 5 convention in the Constitution. We don't need that. As a matter of fact, Madison actually wanted to get rid of it. It was brought forward because people, and I think the good Lord knew, that people did not understand the power that the states possessed. Madison did, and Jefferson did. But getting other people to understand that, that's why they weren't successful in 1798, because people really didn't fathom the power that the states have as the parties to the compact. There were way too many people with their own greed and avarice that wanted to see these collective powers increase. We'll be right back after these two promos with the North Carolina debates. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic Review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're in Monday, July 28th, 1788. And so this is the first round of the ratification debates. And oh, by the way, they never were able to ratify. So they actually had to reconvene the following year in 1789 and ratify. That's why North Carolina was not in the federal government for the first year. They didn't ratify, along with Rhode Island. And so this is Mr. Iredell, and he's basically talking about delegated powers, militia, and so forth. And he says, "Mr. Chairman, I was in hopes
that some other gentleman would have spoken to this clause. It conveys very important powers and ought to not be passed by. I beg leave, and you got to remember, Mr. Iredell is a Federalist. He is in support and arguing for the ratification of the Constitution. I beg leave in as few words as possible to speak my sentiments upon it. I believe most of the governors of the different states have powers similar to those of the president. Now, let me pause right there. As you understand, when we finished the Revolutionary War, King George actually recognized each state as a sovereign state. In other words, each state was equivalent and in comparison to Germany, Britain, France, and all of the different states around the world, China. And so when we start looking at the authority each state possesses, most people look at the executive as this possessor of power. In our constitutional republics, they're just basically executives that are ensuring that the laws of the state or of the nation are being followed and executed. Now, what are real sovereigns, those people who really possess the power, are our representatives. That's why we call it a republican form of government. Anyway, let me move on. And Mr. Iredell says, in almost every country, the executive has the command of the military forces. From the nature of the thing, the command of armies ought to be delegated to one person. The secrecy, dispatch, and decision which are necessary in military operations can only be expected from one person. The president, therefore, is to command the military forces of the United States, and this power, I think, a proper one. At the same time, it will be found to be sufficiently guarded. Now, I'm going to pause again. I want you to understand that in these days, the army didn't exist because the Constitution did not allow for a standing army. So the standing army, for the power to create and or establish an army, that process was bringing forth the militia. If you read Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. In other words, engaging in warfare with foreign states. We were to have, for the most part, a passive army. Our real defense with the rest of the world was expected to be within the Navy and the Marine Corps. Because if it's not on our soil, then who's fighting it? There was never a thought to actually move the army. If you understand, when they start talking about the militia and moving the militia from Georgia all the way up to the Canadian border to protect from an invasion up there, you know, there were lots of states arguing that, hey, that shouldn't be happening unless it's absolutely necessary, and the states buy off on that. But the thought of taking the militia, putting them on ships, and then putting boots on the ground in France to fight in Germany, they didn't even fathom that. But the army at that point in time was the militia. You have to understand that. They're synonymous. It is only when because the militia is a state body, but when they pull forth the militia, they federalize it and it becomes the U.S. Army for a temporary period of time. Because again, the Constitution doesn't allow them to create a standing army for anything more than 2 years. Anyway, getting back to what Mr. Iredell is saying, a very material difference may be observed between this power and the authority of the King of Britain under similar circumstances. The King of Britain is not only the commander-in-chief of the land and naval forces, but has the power in time of war to raise fleets and armies. He has also authority to declare war. The president has not the power of declaring war by his own authority, nor that of raising fleets and armies. These powers are vested in other hands. The power of declaring war is expressly given to Congress, that is, the two branches of the legislature. The Senate, composed of representatives of the states, in the House of Representatives deputed by the people at large. They have also expressly delegated to them the powers of raising and supporting armies and of providing and maintaining a navy. With regard to the militia, it must be observed that though he has the command of them when called into actual service of the United States, yet he has not the power of calling them out. The power of calling them out is vested in Congress for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union. When the militia are called out for any purpose, some person must command them, and who so proper as that person who has the best evidence of possessing the general confidence of the people? I trust, therefore, that the power of commanding the militia when called forth into the actual service of the United States will not be objected. Now, he goes on a little bit further. He goes on and talks, and he talks a little bit about impeachment and common law and holding, because we're talking about the president, we're kind of talking about holding the president accountable for what he's doing. So anyway, this is Mr. Iredell, and he says, the power of impeachment is given by this Constitution to bring great offenders to punishment. It is calculated to bring them to punishment for crime, which is not easy to describe, but which everyone must be convinced is a high crime and misdemeanor against the government. Now, we see how so many of every living president has violated the Constitution and basically has committed a high crime and misdemeanor against the government. Because the government isn't those people who are employed by the federal government. The government is we the people and our constitutional republic, which means that the sovereign states are the parties to that, and the sovereign states have all the authority to enforce this Constitution. Anyway, moving on, Mr. Iredell says this. This power is lodged in those who represent the great body of the people because the occasion for its exercise will arise from acts of great injury to the community, and the objects of it may be as cannot be easily by any ordinary tribunal. The trial belongs to the Senate. Least an inferior tribunal should be too much awed by so powerful an accuser. After trial thus summonly conducted, it is not probable that what would happen once in 1,000 times that a man actually convicted would be entitled to mercy. And if the president had the power of pardoning in such a case, this great check upon high officers of state would lose much of its influence. It seems, therefore, proper that the general power of pardoning should be abridged in this particular instance. The punishment annexed to this conviction on impeachment can only be removal from office and disqualification to hold any place of honor, trust, or profit. But the person convicted is further liable to a trial at common law and may receive such common law punishments as belongs to a description of such offenses. If it be punishable by that law, I hope for the reasons I have started that the whole of this clause will be approved by the committee. The regulations altogether, in my opinion, are wisely contrived as they could be. It is impossible for imperfect beings to form a perfect system. And so, hopefully, this kind of helps lay out how the separation of actually convicting somebody for a crime and the impeachment process of saying you have violated your oath by committing, you know, by not supporting the Constitution and actually by committing a crime against the Constitution. So the impeachment process is literally just a process of removal. It is basically identifying somebody has disqualified themselves by their behavior. This goes hand in hand, and it actually dovetails with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. But the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not include the president because the impeachment process is pretty clear. But getting rid of congressmen and judges and so forth wasn't clear, and it's not that easy. This is why, after the Civil War, we were given by the divine hand of providence this insightful portion of the 14th Amendment that allows us to hold every public servant who takes an oath of office to remove them for violating their oath and committing moral perjury. So I just want you to understand that this whole process, like Section 3 and the impeachment process, is a removal and a removal from emoluments. And this is why I've told you in the past that former presidents today, because they receive lifetime emoluments, can be impeached. Anyway, we've got a hard break. We're going to be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and their 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so here's some good insights. So Mr. Iredell just kind of went through these things regarding, you know, the delegated powers, the militia, and this was all about the second section of Article 2. And so after he finished making these comments regarding the impeachment and some of these other things, because he said, I'm surprised nobody's really talked about this or has come up and objected this. Anyway, this is kind of interesting because Mr. Miller then gets up and he starts injecting on issues of other things, and they start meandering down and actually getting away from the topic at hand. And I believe it's Mr. McClain who comes along and says, you know what, hey, we're not at that part yet, so this person's out of order. But anyway, this is what Mr. Miller basically comes up and says after Mr. Iredell sits down. He says, acknowledge that the explanation of this clause by the member from Eddington had obviated some objections which he had to it. In other words, that Mr. Miller had towards that section of that article. But still, he could not entirely approve of it. He could not see the necessity of vesting this power in the president. He thought that his influence would be too great in the country, and particularly over the military. By being the commander-in-chief of the Army, Navy, and militia, he thought it would be too easy
and was the opinion. Now, you got to understand that the militia being called up does not necessarily equate to the forming of a full army. Only when we're engaged in actually an enemy on the border in the invasion, because there's three parts to the calling up the militias: to execute the laws. We don't need an army to execute the laws of the Union, nor do we need an army to come in and suppress insurrections. But we do need an army when we actually have British forces landing on our shore, or we've got Spanish forces marching up through Georgia. Then we have to federalize, form the army from the militia, and engage the attack. But the militia is the force at ready to be used as necessary. This is why they list them as the Army, Navy, and militia, because the militia can be used as the militia, just like they did with the Whiskey Rebellion in Western Pennsylvania. They didn't send the militia against a foreign enemy. They went to execute the laws of the Union of these rebellious souls in Pennsylvania. Anyway, Mr. Miller says this. He thought that he could easily abuse such extensive powers and was of the opinion that Congress ought to have power to direct the motions of the Army. He considered it as a defect in the Constitution that it was not expressly provided that Congress should have the direction of the motions of the Army. Now, that's absurd. No, there has never been a point in time where you'd have a consensus or a body of people making the dynamic decisions in regards to an engagement of forces where people's lives are on the line. I mean, you know how hard it is to get everybody to agree when you invest the power in a single person, a commander-in-chief. Then the commander-in-chief can create the rules of engagement, and when there are dynamic decisions that need to be made, it can be done most effectively and efficiently. Anyway, Mr. Spate answers Mr. Miller by saying that it was true that the command of the Army and Navy was given to the president, but the Congress, who had the power of raising armies, could certainly prevent any abuse of that authority in the president, that they alone had the means of supporting armies, and that the president was impeachable if in any manner he abused his trust. He was surprised that any objection could be made giving the command to the army of one man, that it was well known that the direction of an army could not be properly exercised by a numerous body of men, that Congress had, in the last war, given the exclusive command to the army commander-in-chief, and that if they had not done so, perhaps the independence of America would not have been established. Then Mr. Porter piped in, "Mr. Chairman, there is a power vested in the Senate and President to make treaties, which shall be the supreme law of the land, which among us can call them to an account. I always thought that there could be no proper exercise of power without the suffrage of the people, yet the House of Representatives has no power to intermeddle with treaties. The president and the seven senators, as nearly as I can remember, can make a treaty which will be the great advantage of the northern states and equal injury to the southern states. They might give up the rivers of the treaty of the southern states, yet in the preamble of the Congress they say that all the people have done it. I should be glad to know that power there is of calling the president and the Senate to account." Mr. Spate basically pipes up and says that under the Confederation, two-thirds of the states might make treaties that if the senators from the states attended when a treaty was about to be made, two-thirds of the states would have a voice in its formation. He added that he would be glad to ask the gentleman what mode there was of calling the present Congress to an account. Mr. Porter repeated his objection. He hoped that the gentleman would not impose on the House that the president could make treaties with two-thirds of the Senate, and the president in that case voted rather in a legislative than in an executive capacity, which he thought impolitic. Now, Governor Johnston pipes in and says, "Mr. Chairman, in my opinion," it's kind of interesting that the governor is not the chairman, why they didn't select him because I believe Governor Johnston was one of the few governors like Randolph that was actually at the Constitution. I think I'd have to actually go back and look, but he was definitely a Federalist. The three governors that I know that actually stood up, or wasn't a governor at the time, I think John Hancock wasn't, but he served as governor and executive, and he was also, I think, the executive of the Continental Congress, Johnston as well as Randolph. There were three governors or executives that looked at this Constitution, but most all other governors saw this as a threat to their fiefdoms or to their cabal. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, if there be any difference between this Constitution and the Confederation with respects to treaties, the Constitution is more safe than the Confederation. We know that two members from each state have a right by the Confederation to give the vote of the state, and two-thirds of the states have a right also to make treaties. By this Constitution, two-thirds of the senators cannot make treaties without the concurrence of the president. Here is then an additional guard. The calculation of that seven or eight senators with the president can make treaties is totally erroneous. 14 is the quorum. Two-thirds, which are 10, it is upon the improbable supposition that they will not attend, that the objection is founded that 10 men with the president can make treaties. Can it be reasonably supposed that they will not attend when the most important business is agitated, with the interests of the respective states are most immediately affected? Now, here's the beautiful part. Because remember, what they were talking about was the commander-in-chief. Mr. McLean then stood up and observed that the gentleman was out of order with his objection, that they had not come to that clause which enables the president and the Senate to make treaties. Boop. And that reels everybody back in and goes, oh, okay, so let's get back to, you know, the part of the Constitution. Because, see, they're going through this line by line, and it only took a quick second for somebody to inject a curveball or bring something in from out of play to say, hey, what about this? And next thing you know, you have the reality check of Mr. McLean coming in and going, hey, let's get back on the focus of the, you know, what we're actually debating so that we don't start wandering down these other little paths. And so Mr. Spencer now gets up and makes an objection regarding jurisdiction. He is also an anti-federalist. Now, I'm including some of these things to help you understand how the argument was pitched and then how they basically refuted the argument. Because Mr. Spate will follow up and refute this. Mr. Chairman, I have an objection to this article. I believe that the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court in all cases of law and equity arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States, and to the appellate jurisdiction of controversies between states, between citizens of different states, and a fewer other instances, to this I object because I believe they will be oppressive in their operation. I would wish that the federal court should not interfere or have anything to do with controversies to the decision of which state judiciaries might be fully competent, nor with the such controversies as must carry the people a great way from home with respect to the jurisdiction of eases arising under the Constitution. When we reflect on the very extensive objects of the plain government, the manner in which they may arise, and the multiplicity of laws that may be made with respect to them, the objection against it will appear to be well-founded. If we consider nothing but the articles of taxation, duties, and excises, and the laws that might be made with respect to these, the eases will almost be infinite. If we consider that it is in contemplation that a stamp duty should take place throughout the continent, that all contracts shall be on stamp paper, that no contract shall be of validity, but what would be thus stamped? And so we'll take a pause right there, and we'll come back into his objection regarding the jurisdiction. But here's the interesting thing, because he's talking about the jurisdiction, and I want you to remember that the 11th Amendment came out in the 1790s. I forget when it was ratified, But it didn't take long for the states to assert their power. We'll be right back.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's just take it up where we left off. That's what I kind of read through to the break of thought. These cases will be so many that the consequences would be dreadful. It would be necessary to appoint judges to the federal court and other inferior departments, and such a number of inferior courts in every district and county with a correspondent number of officers that it would cost an immense expense without any apparent necessity, which must operate to the distress of the inhabitants. There will be, without any manner of doubt, clashings and animosities between the jurisdiction of the federal courts and of the state courts, so that they will keep the country in hot water. It has been said that the impropriety of this was mentioned by some in the convention. I cannot see the reasons of giving the federal courts jurisdiction in these cases, but I am sure it will be occasion great expense unnecessarily. The state judiciaries will have very little to do. It will be almost useless to keep them up, as all officers are to take an oath to support the general government. It will carry everything before it. This will produce that consolidation through the United States, which is apprehended. I am sure that I do not see that it is possible to avoid it. I can see no power that can keep up the little remains of the powers of the states. Our rights are not guarded. There is no declaration of rights to secure to every member of the society those inalienable rights which ought to be not given up to any government. Such a Bill of Rights would be a check upon men in power. Instead of such a Bill of Rights, this Constitution has a clause which may warrant encroachments on the power of the respective state legislatures. I know it is said that it was not given up to the United States, will be retained by the individual states. I know it ought to be so and should be so understood, but sir, it is not declared to be so. In the Confederation, it is expressly declared that all rights and powers of any kind, whatever, of the several states which are not given up to the United States are expressly and absolutely retained to be enjoyed by the states.
there ought to be a Bill of Rights in order that those in power may not step over the boundary between the powers of government and the rights of the people, which they may not do. There is nothing to prevent them. There may be, without a Bill of Rights, notice will be readily taken of the encroachment of rulers, and they may go a great length before the people are alarmed. Oppression is like what's going on right now, but again, all of these things would be violations of the Constitution. He goes on and says, oppression may therefore take place by degrees, but if there were express terms and bounds laid down when these were passed by the people, would take notice of them, and oppressions would not be carried on to such length. I look upon it, therefore, that there ought to be something to confine the power of this government when its improper boundaries are within, to confine the power of this government within the proper boundaries. I know that several writers have said that the Bill of Rights is not necessary in this country, and that some states had not and others had. To these answers, to those states that have them, not as a Bill of Rights, strictly so called, have them in the frame of their constitution, which is nearly the same. And so he kind of talks about the jurisdiction of the courts and the necessity of having a Bill of Rights to keeping things in their proper jurisdiction and perspective. So then Mr. Speight comes along, and this is what he says. Mr. Chairman, the gentleman insinuates that differences existed in the Federal Convention respecting the clause which he objects to. Whoever told him so was wrong, for I declare that in the convention, the unanimous desire of all was to keep separate and distinct the objects of the jurisdiction of the federal government from that of any state judiciary. Now, I want to emphasize what he just said. Whoever told him so was wrong, for I declare, because he was there as a delegate at the convention, for I declare that in the convention, the unanimous desire of all was to keep separate the distinct, to keep separate and distinct the objects of jurisdiction of the federal from that of the state judiciary. They wish to separate them judiciously as possible and to consult the ease and convenience of the people. Thus, I'm just throwing it in here, this is why they quickly turned around and created the 11th Amendment to ensure that the federal court's jurisdiction was constrained more in protecting the rights of the states over matters of state issues between states and citizens of other states. The gentleman objects to the cognizance of all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. This objection is very astonishing. When any government is established, it ought to have the power to enforce its laws, or else it might well have no power. So you understand what he just said is that all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution and the laws in pursuant to the Constitution, this objection is astonishing. When every government is established, it ought to have the power to enforce its laws, or else it might as well have no power. But what that is the use of a judiciary? The gentleman from his profession must know that no government can exist without a judiciary to enforce its laws. By distinguishing the disobedient from the rest of the people and imposing sanctions for securing the execution of the laws as to the inconvenience of distance attendance, Congress has the power of establishing inferior tribunals in each state so as to accommodate every citizen. As Congress have it in their power, will they not do it? Are we to elect men who will wantonly and necessarily betray us? Then Mr. McLean pipes in. And this is what Mr. McLean says. And he says, Mr. Chairman, I hope that some gentleman more capable than myself would have obviated the objections of this part. The objections offered by the gentleman appear to me totally without foundation. He told us that these clauses tended to a consolidation of the states. I cannot see how the states are to be consolidated by establishing these two clauses. He enumerated a number of cases which would be involved with the cognizance of the federal court, customs, excises, duties, stamp duties, a stamp on an article on every contract in order to bring all persons into the federal court, and said that there would be necessarily courts in every district and county, which would be attended with normal and needless expense. For that, the state courts could do everything. He went on further and said that there would be a necessity of having sheriffs and other officers in these inferior departments. A wonderful picture indeed, drawn up in a wonderful manner. I will venture to say that the gentleman's suggestions are not warranted by any reasonable construction of the Constitution. The laws can, in general, be executed by the officers of the states. State courts and state officers will, for the most part, probably answer the purpose of Congress as well as by any other. But the gentleman says that the state courts will be swallowed up by the federal courts. This is only a general assertion, unsupported by any probable reason or arguments. The objects of each are separate and distinct. I support that whatever courts there may be, they will be established according to the convenience of the people. This we must suppose from the mode of electing and appointing the members of the government. State officers, which will as much be possible be employed for one very considerable reason, and I mean to lessen the expense. But he imagines that the oath to be taken by officers will tend to the subversion of our state governments and our liberty. Can any government exist without the fidelity of its officers? Ought not the officers of every government be given security for the faithful discharge of their trust? The officers are not only sworn to support the Constitution and therefore will be bound by their oath so far as it be strictly pursued. No officer will be bound by his oath to support any act that would violate the principles of the Constitution. And so we don't have, you know, enough time to really get into the next argument regarding the Bill of Rights and the enumerating of powers, and because this is where we're getting into some really good meat. But the fact is that the federal government's jurisdiction does not include marriage. The federal government, because let's say somebody was able to marry their car in one state and then go into another state and say, hey, I claim reciprocity because I was able to marry my car in that state and I want to be able to have the full benefits of my car being my spouse and having my car covered by my insurance and so forth and so on. And I mean, I'm just using this as an example. Well, that could never go into the federal court because the federal court has, and even though that contract of marriage may have been done by one state and now he's in another state suing, the states have full jurisdiction over the laws of marriage. The federal courts has no. And so this little portal of saying, oh, well, if this is a person of one state and trying to sue another state, whether they be in that state or otherwise, that the state could try to sue another state over those types of things. Again, if it's about marriage and one state suing, even if it's a state suing another state, it is a state issue. And the federal court has to look at the jurisdiction and say clearly, we don't have any jurisdiction over marriage, and so it is a state issue, just like slavery. You choose to have slavery, then you have that destiny or that foreordained power. Anyway, we will be back with the Bill of Rights and more enumerating powers in our next episode in North Carolina. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we will be back.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.